pardon my interruption, but I'm honored to introduce our distinguished luncheon speaker. Michael Chertoff is in the middle, at least I hope it's the middle, of a long and distinguished career of public service as a federal prosecutor, a Justice Department official, a federal appellate judge, and most recently as Secretary of Homeland Security. Currently at the Chertoff Group, he provides high-level strategic counsel to governments and corporations in the national security area. So without further ado, Secretary Chertoff.
Thanks a lot. I should, for completeness, also say that I'm of counsel at Covington & Burling, so I do practice law from time to time. It's great to be here. What a great setting. And I'm delighted to be here to talk about what I think is the most interesting case of the term. Not the healthcare case, though. And that may turn out to be the most interesting, but I actually think that the case I'm going to talk about, U.S. v. Jones, is the most interesting. And, you know, I always find, after years of practicing law and seeing it as a prosecutor, defense attorney, and as a judge, I always think the most interesting periods of time in the law are when the legal structures that we have built up over a period of time collide with reality. And at some point, there's a period of discomfort while we try to force reality into the legal categories that we're comfortable with. And then finally, people start to give up, and they say, maybe we have to change the legal categories to fit what the facts are. You probably saw that in the earlier panel on detention. A lot of the stress of the last 10 years in legal circles had to do with how do you accommodate what was a binary regime where you had either war or crime, and you had a separate parallel processes, departments, and rules and regulations depending on which box you put something in. And of course, as we discovered in 2001, the reality didn't fit this neat categorization. It was perfectly possible to have a situation where the same individual could be both committing a crime and engaging in illegal warfare, and our reaction would depend a great deal on where they happened to be at the time that we encountered them, but not necessarily because of legal categories, but rather a set of practical circumstances. Well, another area in which this is happening is the area of surveillance, privacy, the collection of data and information about people, the retention, the analysis of that data, and the use that's made out of that data. Now, again, we've lived in a regime largely constructed in the 20th century in which we've had some pretty clear categories about how we deal with these issues. You know, we had the public-private distinction. If you're out in public, it's all fair game. Anything that's seen or heard by somebody who's on the same street as you are is capable of being used by law enforcement, if they can see it or if they can hear it themselves. So that was a very neat distinction. There just were neat distinctions between whether you intercept communications with consent or without consent. And then very little limitation on what you could do with the information once you intercepted it. But here's the problem. The problem is that the technology and the circumstances have enormously changed. The distinction between public and private, which has been part of the fabric of our Fourth and Fifth Amendment law for over a century, that has hit headlong into the reality that what we are capable of collecting, retaining, and making public or publishing has dramatically changed in the last 10 years. There are a series of embedded assumptions about what it means to be in public that actually rely on what I call the friction of modern life. In other words, yes, we're in public, but we don't actually think everybody is always paying attention to us at every moment. an inelegant example of this is watching what people do in the privacy of their automobile through the window when they're at a stoplight as they groom themselves. You know, they obviously are in public, but they're not thinking of themselves as being perceived all the time. Another assumption that we always made was that things that are collected are often lost, they're forgotten, they're not particularly capable of being aggregated. So maybe you do something in public in Washington and you do something public in San Francisco, but nobody ever connects the dots. So the friction of time, distance, and memory over some span of time and space tend to degrade the value of the information, the saliency of the information, and in the end, the data is lost. So there's a kind of a forgetfulness that's been embedded in our assumptions about public and private until the last decade or so. Now let's fast forward to where we are now. In the modern world, there is almost ubiquitous and persistent ability to surveil and see anything that's in public. It doesn't rely upon whether someone loses concentration. There are cities that have, and not only here but in London as well, that have surveillance cameras virtually all over the place, and they can operate 24/7, and they don't miss very much, and they don't get tired. A second feature of what we have now is the ability through the internet to aggregate and collect unbelievable amounts of information in a variety of different places, all of which happen to be open source in the sense that they're not deliberately walled off from being identified and being captured, and which wind up yielding an enormous amount of knowledge to somebody who's interested in looking at that knowledge. And that is a huge change. Again, in the old days, even if different people saw you do different things, the chances of them getting it together and collecting it were highly remote, if not wholly impossible. Third change is it never goes away. All the pictures and files that we used to keep manually that after a period of time crumbled now are forever in digital space. And so when you bring these things together, the increased capability to collect, the ability to integrate and aggregate, and the ability to keep it forever, that has really transformed or frankly eliminated friction as it relates to what you do in public. So this has been, I think, a tension that has been out there for some period of time. And I will have to say, I think part of what you have seen in terms of the increased anxiety about the issue of privacy has been a reflection of the fact that these phenomena are not fully understood and the law hasn't really taken account of them. I'm not saying whether it's good or bad. What I am saying is it has changed the landscape in terms of privacy. One more element has changed, and that is the ability of analytics to take all of this data and sort it out in a way that is usable by people for operational purposes. You know, you all remember the scene from the end of, I guess, the first Raiders of the Lost Ark, where they get the Ark, and it's the most powerful thing in the world. And finally, when they capture it, the last scene is some huge government warehouse where it's in a box, and it gets shoved up in the top of, you know, a column, and it's there forgotten forever. And that used to be what happened with the data, and that's not true anymore. The ability to recall it, to connect the dots, to analyze it, has meant that that information becomes a much more powerful operational tool. Now, these have all been, frankly, very, very important developments in what the national security establishment has been able to do in terms of dramatically increasing the likelihood that we can detect terrorists or other people who threaten violence or destruction against our society. You know, the challenge we had at the beginning of the period after 9/11 was to find the equivalent of radar in a world in which the enemy doesn't bomb you with airplanes or missiles, but comes in wearing civilian clothes and backpacks. And just as radar gave us the ability to detect attacks in the 20th century, the ability to collect data, integrate it and analyze it was the key to giving us the measure protection we have today. In fact, I would venture to say that this transformation, a lot of it actually spurred by 9/11, has been the single reason why we have not had more attacks and more successful attacks here in the United States and even in other parts of the West. So this has been a huge development from a national security standpoint. But I think it was inevitable at some point the law would confront the change that this means in terms of what is expected by being in public and what is expected about being in private, and would start to wrestle with that. And I think Jones is the first example of the Supreme Court taking up this issue. You had it a little bit with the Kylo case, a few years back, which involved the heat sensing of what goes on in a building. But that was a relatively easy decision. I mean, it was based on the premise that you're using technology to develop a capability that you could not do as a human being. And so you can distinguish that and say, well, that's really kind of like in the category of intercepting telephone conversations. It's a technological transformative step in terms of your intelligence gathering, but it's not something that a human being could do on their own. But Jones confronts a different issue. It confronts the issue of persistent surveillance. Public space, no question about the fact that the case involved an automobile and involved a GPS tracker put on the automobile, but everything that was being sensed or observed or tracked was out in the open. So it's a classic case of something in public. And yet the court, for the first time, I think, came to confront the changed reality of what the technology means and tried to address it. Now, I'm going to tell you right up front, I don't find the answers satisfactory, but I do think it's interesting and important that the questions are now being asked, although how we resolve them will have profound impact on the way we not only do our law enforcement, but the way we protect ourselves against foreign and domestic enemies. As you all know, the majority decision took what I would consider to be you could either call it the easy way out, or you could say it's a politic way to deal with the issue as narrowly as possible. And that was to say, because there was an actual attachment of something to the vehicle, it's a trespass. It's like the old-fashioned, you know, offensive touching where you touch someone on the hand, and that's sufficient to be a trespass. Now, is that a meaningful principle on which you want to base important concepts like privacy and the government's power to surveil? Probably not. Is it a way to deal with this case, which obviously all the justices found to be disturbing as a warrantless search, and put to one side, maybe for legislative action, the broader set of issues? The answer to that is probably yes. It's a good way to sidestep the issue. But what's really interesting about the case are the four concurring opinions, or rather the four justices who concurred, one of whom, Justice Sotomayor, concurred in the majority, and the others who concurred separately in an opinion by Justice Alito. Because this really was the attempt to grapple with what are the larger set of questions here. Now, let me begin with Justice Alito. most of the opinion is obviously aimed at dealing with what the majority does and the unsatisfactoriness of the trespass test. But in the latter part of the opinion, the justices start to talk about if we used a reasonable expectations test, the CATS test, as a touchstone of privacy, how would we come out in this case? And that what they judge is that because they view a four-week surveillance as something that with human unaided agents would be unforeseeable as something that could happen, therefore this is outside of the reasonable or inside the reasonable expectation of privacy. A person would not reasonably expect 4 weeks of constant surveillance, and therefore doing it by a mechanism as opposed to human beings constitutes a Fourth Amendment violation. Now, I have to pause and say this is a stunning statement. The pivotal statement in the opinion is, and I want to make full disclosure, I was Justice Alito's first assistant. When he was U.S. attorney, I was a colleague on the Third Circuit. I love him. He's a wonderful person. So I'm not criticizing personally. But the statement that you could not anticipate, a reasonable person should not expect that he's going to be followed for 4 weeks and that therefore doing so with technology constitutes a search, is utterly without support. There's nothing in the record, there's no footnote, there's no citation, and I have to tell you from my own personal knowledge, it's far from extraordinary to imagine that in a certain kind of case, you could have persistent on-again 4 week or even a several month surveillance of somebody. And yet the thought that this entire opinion pivots on this unsubstantiated observation that 4 weeks of surveillance is something that's simply beyond what anybody would expect, I think illustrates how novel this area is and how difficult it is to grapple with. It also illustrates the fact that the reasonable expectation of privacy test, as has been observed for decades now, is really ultimately circular and not particularly helpful. It's really an invitation for the judges to say not what would a reasonable person expect, but what do I personally think is, from my own standpoint, over the line of offensiveness. So that is, of course, the opinion joined by four of the justices. Justice Sotomayor is a little bit gets a little bit deeper into this, and actually is a more interesting opinion in the sense that it talks about a wider range of issues that are presented than just the question of surveilling someone, following them around. Justice Sotomayor actually deals with issues like, raises questions about, like, well, how long should this information be kept? And if it's kept for a long time, does that make it into a Fourth Amendment violation? Now, think about this for a second. I'm not aware of a case, and I can't say I'm a, you know, I've made a lifetime study of this, where keeping something for a long period of time that you got lawfully makes it into a Fourth Amendment violation. That would be a very novel position to take under the Fourth Amendment. Even more interesting was Justice Sotomayor's pointing to the fact that with modern analytic capability, you can actually take all this information that you have collected, even from open sources, things that are totally out there in public, and you can manipulate it in ways to give you an in-depth understanding of what a person does that is far beyond what would have been the case 10 or 20 years ago. And she raises the question whether that constitutes a Fourth Amendment violation. Now, let me explain why these are really provocative and interesting questions. And again, I'm not saying what the answer here is. I'm not saying I agree with her suggested answer, but I think they're good questions. When you talk about analytic capabilities that are brought to national security or law enforcement using modern computer tools, what you're talking about is in much more quickly and much more comprehensively being able to take a lot of individual facts, array them in a way that gives you some sense of what the common patterns are, and then to draw conclusions from those patterns. Now, that is something investigators and prosecutors have done since they first had investigators and prosecutors. They didn't do it as quickly. They weren't able to master as much information, and they weren't able to be as comprehensive about it. But it's basically the same function, just taken up several notches in terms of mental horsepower. So what is Justice Sotomayor suggesting here? She's suggesting that at some level, part of the Fourth Amendment or part of the right to privacy involves the right to have analytics be done in a way that's not too smart. In other words, you can have people analyze evidence that's legally collected, but if they're too good at it because they're enhanced with technology, then now it becomes a Fourth Amendment violation. So does that mean that the Fourth Amendment requires a kind of a stupid policeman as a protector of our rights? And if not, what is the limit to the kind of technological enhancement of intelligence you can use before you wind up going from something that doesn't require a warrant to something that does require a warrant? If you use, lights so you can read at night, does that take you over the line? If you use IBM-style computers from the 1960s, does that take you over the line? So these, I think, are in many ways really provocative questions, and they also lend themselves to some serious issues about line drawing. So having laid this out, let me try to unpack what I think are kind of the main issues we are going to have to confront, not necessarily in court, maybe more appropriately in Congress, as we deal with how we move forward on these new tools in a national security environment. And the reason I think it's important the questions be raised now is, and I'm going to hark back to the morning's discussion, Congress did not take up the task of laying out a framework for detention and interrogation in the what used to be called the War on Terror until rather late in the game. And the consequence of that is it left it to the courts to put together a system for dealing with that, which was more or less ad hoc. I wonder whether we're getting to the same position here in which the court has now signaled in the absence of Congress, and there are several invitations in the opinions, by the way, for Congress to get involved, but in the absence of Congress, we're going to start weighing in on this. So it may be that this is the kickoff of a period of serious discussion about what these rules ought to be. So let me break them into what I think are several categories, each of which requires, I think, a lot of discussion and thought in the time to come. First, collection. To go back to my earlier point, We have always collected information in public. And by the way, this is not a discussion about what occurs in your house or occurs on your telephone when you're talking to somebody. Those rules are actually pretty well settled and pretty easy. We're not talking about the domain of what is public, and therefore what was always considered to be not something that required any kind of Fourth Amendment permission. It was something that was open to law enforcement and to the national security folks without seeking any kind of court order. So now we have the ability to collect hugely more effectively than was the case before. We have video surveillance, as I said, in many cities. We have GPS, which gives locational information about where you are based on your car or your cell phone, literally in real time. As we've read in the paper, we're likely to have an increased use of unmanned aerial vehicles, which, again, have tremendous surveillance capability over a wide aperture. All of these add enormously to the ability to have virtually ubiquitous eyes on what is going in public space 24/7. Now, there are some differences in the technology, and they may have some impact in whether we view these types of techniques as being Fourth Amendment or not Fourth Amendment in terms of implications. For example, when you have like an OnStar or a GPS that emits a signal to a tower or to some other location, it may be that intercepting that signal puts you into a different category. It may be that obtaining that signal after it's been after it's been received, again, changes the legal mix a little bit. Obviously, when you're dealing with cameras or drones, you're not dealing with anything that's emanating from the vehicle or from the cell phone. You're dealing with something that you're putting on it. You're putting eyes on something or cameras on something. Perhaps that makes it a little bit different from the emanations. So the issue of active interrogation, whether you're looking at something or passive interrogation, you're capturing something coming back, the question whether it's a communication between point to point or something that is more generally emanated out there, all of these are details that may or may not affect the analysis, but will have to be looked at in terms of deciding how you draw the line on these kinds of persistent surveillance. In this respect, I think if you go back to what you saw in Jones, what kind of troubles the justices, they seem to be troubled by the fact, again, that this is really switched on all the time. And it may be wedded to a notion that back in the 19th century and when the Constitution was framed, it just, you know, you didn't have robust police forces. So the embedded expectation in public was that, yeah, you were in public, but you were only kind of semi in public. That's that concept of friction again. The friction involved in collection was relatively high, and that meant you could strike the balance in a way that didn't require a warrant to do surveillance in public. Because that's changed, I think certainly Justice Alito and Justice Sotomayor seem to view us as in a somewhat different environment with a somewhat different paradigm. A second question, which I think only Justice Sotomayor raised, but I think is going to become part of this discussion, is what I said earlier. It's this issue of the persistence of records. The Europeans have gotten very interested in this issue through what they're now talking about as a right to forget. They want to have people whose data is accumulated be able to go to the agency that accumulates it and say, after a certain period of time, I want you to forget what you know about me. Or we've had discussion in this country about whether you should be able to go to companies that collect your information because you hit their website and insist that after some period of time they delete that information and delete it permanently. So again, this is an area perhaps not so widely discussed here, but certainly discussed in Europe, that I think, again, certainly troubled Justice Sotomayor, troubles the Europeans, and I think is likely to be an issue more in the future. A final issue that was raised in the opinion by Justice Sotomayor was this is too inexpensive. She seemed to view the fact that the surveillance is not only ubiquitous, but that it's cheap to be the removal of another limiting factor or element of friction that in the old days meant that when we were in public, we weren't really that much in public. We had some ability to count on the passage of time to erase what we had been observed doing or saying. So again, I think this is going to be an issue that, as we move forward, is going to be of increased concern to these people. So what's my own view on this? I do think that on the collection space, while I can see a basis to argue that emanations from your car, GPS, OnStar, similar types of devices that go to a cell tower or go to a particular operation center, at least to me, raise Fourth Amendment implications. Maybe to me the analogy is similar to telephones, whether they're wireless or wireline. You are talking about a signal. It is a signal that the owner is intending to go only to one location. Without getting into the question of whether you need a warrant or something less than a warrant, I can see those as being Fourth Amendment, having Fourth Amendment implications. I'm less inclined to see that in the area of camera surveillance and whether it's fixed cameras or drones, partly because there really is no difference at all between that and the eyeball. And I find the argument that you'd need a lot of agents to do a surveillance, and therefore the fact that a camera spares you the need to use those agents makes it a Fourth Amendment violation, to really turn the Fourth Amendment on its head. It no longer becomes about protecting what your expectations are. It becomes kind of a resource management and budget issue with respect to law enforcement. And it's hard to see what the Fourth Amendment principle at issue there is. On the issue of persistence, I have trouble with the idea that the fact that we can now keep records and keep them accessible and analyze them better means that we've transformed what was hitherto not a Fourth Amendment problem into a Fourth Amendment problem. And again, because it really is a question not of the information, whether you're doing anything with it that is different than you used to do before. It's just that you're better at it. And looking at it from a kind of judicial standpoint, it's hard to know what the principle of decision-making would be. Would it be the you can only analyze and keep it as long as the reasonable police officer could do it in the age of paper and pencil? Can it be a really smart police officer? Can we assume that we had word processors? I mean, as you start to think about how you're going to deal with this issue, you see the line drawing problem gets you out of the area of principle and more into the area of operational practice, which strikes me as not a very happy place when you're doing Fourth Amendment violations. So let me talk about a couple of other elements to the analysis I think might be helpful as we start to think about how we deal with these problems. One is, I do think that an embedded concern in the opinions in the Jones case is, why are we doing this? A couple of the opinions talk about the fact that it might be reasonable to do something like this in a case involving terrorism or some extreme threat, but not in the case at hand. Now, as it happens, the case in hand is a drug case, so it's perhaps not the best fact pattern to make that argument. But I take the signal here to be this, and I think it's actually a very important point. There's an element of proportionality here, and it may be, you know, the Fourth Amendment talks about reasonable and unreasonable. It is an amendment that is drafted not in terms of absolutes, but it virtually invites balancing to some degree in the context of reasonableness. And I think we might say, you know, there are certain types of surveillance that we would regard as reasonable if we're trying to save life and limb that we don't necessarily view as reasonable if we're trying to catch people who are exceeding the speed limit. I pick that example because if you drove here, chances are you went by a speed camera. There are now speed cameras all over Washington, D.C., and I'll confess on a personal note, I'm offended by it. Now, why am I, so I've asked myself, why am I offended by it? And the answer is not because I'm against surveillance, because I think if I know in Chicago, for example, video surveillance in high crime areas has reduced crime. I think if you're going to prevent acts of violence or robberies or acts of terror with video surveillance, I'm not offended at all by that. If you're going to use it to catch people who litter or who exceed their parking, or who speed, then I am offended by it. So now this is just an intuition, but I'm suggesting that it may turn out to be that part of what needs to be in the solution to how we draw the lines here is some idea of preventing mission creep. When I was Secretary of DHS, I found one of the challenges we got from the Europeans was on this issue of proportionality. They would say, well, why are you doing, you know, we can understand why you want to collect this information for counterterrorism, but why do you want it for tax purposes? And truthfully, I think that's, you know, I don't hesitate to say when I disagree with the Europeans, but I thought that was actually not not an invalid point, that there are many things you can do that are wrong, but they're not all that serious. And when you're doing things that potentially seriously invade people's privacy in the sense of collection of information, you may want to calibrate based on why you're doing it. And finally, I'd like to turn to what I think is maybe the biggest challenge and the biggest flaw in everything I've said about building a construct for law enforcement and national security agencies as they wrestle with what is really public and what is no longer public, what should get Fourth Amendment protection, what shouldn't get protection. And that goes back to the original formulation of the reasonable expectation test. Remember, go back to Katz. Supposedly, what we are protecting people from is an invasion of their reasonable expectation of privacy. And the government shouldn't be able to invade that expectation. So if we're now talking about limiting the government's ability to collect information with video, to aggregate it and to retain it and to analyze it, because we think that it's going too far invading people's reasonable expectation of privacy, how do we square that with the fact that right now in the private sector, all of these things are being done to a degree at least as invasive as the government, if not further? Exhibit one, you walk down the street, someone takes this out, they decide they want to film you. For whatever reason, the way you're dressed, because you happen to be well-known, they upload it, and now they make it available to the whole world. We basically have, and if you're a celebrity, you know, someone like George Clooney, you probably experience virtually 24/7 constant video surveillance in public using this. It's not done by the government. It's not even done by a single agency. It's done by what we could call the hive. People who spontaneously come together to decide they want to record you and upload you. So what's the reasonable expectation of privacy? Persistence, aggregation. There are businesses now which have staggering market cap, Google, Facebook, which are based upon the ability to collect large amount of information, retain it forever, manipulate it through analytics, and make it available for commercial purposes so you can be sold stuff. So are we going to say to the government, well, okay, people have a reasonable expectation of privacy when willy-nilly they put in for public consumption with fair warning that it's going to be used and sold for commercial purposes, the most personal details of their lives? Is that the reasonable expectation of privacy? What I'm saying is that in many ways, the challenge raised by Jones is not just what is the architecture for law enforcement, but does law enforcement actually have to be more respecting of privacy than the private sector? Or to be more pointed, does a guy sitting in a cave or in a compound over in Pakistan or Afghanistan or Yemen have more ability, should he have more ability to surveil what we do here on the streets of Washington than the FBI agent who's trying to prevent a bomb going off? And that is really ultimately, to my mind, the most profound internal contradiction that we're going to have to wrestle with as we accept the invitation that Jones presents to look at new technologies and privacy, which is this. Do we say that as long as the private sector has the capability to invade privacy to a certain extent, the government should at least be able to go that far? Do we say the government should be able to do less than a criminal can do or a terrorist can do? Or do we say, and this is probably the right answer, we need to synchronize all of these things. And we need to ask ourselves some serious questions about whether the things we are valuing as privacy are perhaps not necessarily valued by the next generation. They may value certain things more and certain things less. So I've thrown a lot of questions out. I've given you really no answers. But I hope I've given you something to think about to illustrate my earlier point. I think this case, maybe even including the healthcare case, is the most interesting case of the term. Not because it resolves anything. I think it's pretty clear it doesn't. But because it is the court begging Congress and society to come to grips with this problem and put a solution together that begins to answer the questions. And I dare say if we've learned any lesson from what we did in the area of detention about the value of doing this rather than leaving it for the courts, we ought to get busy thinking about these problems now. So with that, I'm happy to take some questions. Of course, it's all being recorded. It's going to be uploaded, so.
Judge, Michael Vadas from Steptoe & Johnson. One of the other interesting aspects of the Sotomayor opinion was her raising the issue of the third-party doctrine, which holds that if you disclose information to a third party, such as a bank or a telecommunications provider, you have no reasonable expectation of privacy anymore because that third party knows about that information. And that, if that doctrine were basically eradicated, it would have major implications for a lot of the surveillance that's done now, because so much information is gathered by the government from communications providers and financial institutions and the like. And you would raise the point that you could see there being a Fourth Amendment issue if the government's collecting that information, your car beams to its manufacturer through the GPS or OnStar, or the signals that your cell phone communicates to its provider. But in fact, the third party doctrine would say there's actually no Fourth Amendment issue there. So do you have any thoughts about that or the likelihood that that doctrine might be eliminated or
replaced? Again, I mean, I think it's a great question. And there's so much you could cover in this. I think it was one of the most provocative things about her opinion, because we've always accepted, for example, that although you can't in real time intercept certain things, you can later subpoena them if they're in the hands of a third party. That may or may not have made sense, but it's been certainly a well-understood set of principles in the Fourth Amendment area. I think Justice Sotomayor, again, I'm not suggesting I think she's right about this, but she at least raises the question whether that ought to change, again, given the scale of information that is now in the hands of third parties and the ability to aggregate it. This goes to the point about the analytics piece. What she seems to be troubled by is the idea that we're just so much better now at being able to take little dots of information and make a picture out of them because of our ability to enhance our analytic capabilities. And therefore, you can have a very granular understanding of what people do almost every minute of their lives without actually doing any of what would traditionally have been regarded as highly intrusive things like wiretapping their telephone or surveilling them inside their houses, just because there's a huge amount of data out there. I have to say, it would be a revolution to begin to impose the Fourth Amendment on that type of collection of information. And I'll come back to my final point. A good deal of this now is done by the private sector. I mean, background checks, credit checks, they absorb huge amounts of personal information. And fully understood and fair warning given, although not always paid attention to, by consumers out there. So you're going to have a circumstance where again, is the government more constrained? Now, you can make an argument that that's true. The government has more power. But I come back to the point that troubles me, which is I hate to think that a guy sitting in Yemen trying to detonate bombs has greater visibility into what we all do, or a foreign agent has greater visibility into what we all do than our government does. You remind me of one other point. Again, there are many different ways to perspectives to take on this problem. When you look at the issue of video surveillance, does it matter whether you are targeting a particular person and following him or her around, or if you're looking at everybody and then every day at the end of your surveillance, or perhaps in real time, you are using analytics to look at the whole crowd to identify people out there who might be doing something dangerous? By analogy to the checkpoint cases, the drunk driving cases, it might very well be that the court would be offended by the first and not by the second. Whether that's a sensible distinction or not, I'm not clear on. But again, it's another way to look at how you enter into this kind of mass of complication. Yes.
Hello, sir. Sylvia Ross. I think I'm probably the most paranoid person in the room because I'm such a technological dinosaur that I have no idea half of what goes off my computer goes to whom. But I think that gut check yuck feeling I get with some of this is that previously this was only within the purview of an omniscient God. He could only look at all this stuff and not have a problem with it. And yet, is there a way that we can go back to some very fundamental principles as to what is the limited purpose of government to make those distinctions, that it is truly to punish evil, to do, and then we have to answer the question as to what constitutes evil. But I have a problem with the idea of a government becoming suddenly all-knowing. It does increase their power, and that's beyond, that's, I think, the uncomfortable thing I think that's trying to be articulated in these cases, some sort of non-omniscience doctrine.
I think you're right. I think there's an intuition people have that they've become slowly more aware of the huge change in huge power that you draw from being able to collect information at a very, very granular level on a mass scale. The people who understand this better than everybody else are the people who market and try to sell stuff. They picked it up right away. That's why Facebook and Google have huge market caps. That's why, you know, Zuckerberg and Brin are rich, because the power of information is worth more than gold. So I think you're asking the right question. Are we going to stop collection? It's virtually impossible because it's going to happen in the private sector unless you make it illegal. So maybe the right questions to ask are, what can you do with the information? What use are you allowed to make of it? Does the amount you retain depend on the purpose you're retaining it? In other words, should we say if it's matters of life and death, you have a broad capability to collect and retain? If it's speeding and parking tickets, you really don't. And then I also think it's important to say, how do you synchronize what we're going to tell the government to do and the private sector to do? Because although the government can certainly do things can hurt you more than commercial entities can. Commercial entities can do quite a bit of damage in terms of your personal security, in terms of publicly disseminating information about you. I mean, here's a great example. If a commercial entity collects a lot of information about you and it winds up getting stolen because they don't have good cybersecurity, and now it gets out there and it can be used by criminals for all kinds of bad purposes, I mean, that's pretty serious consequence as well. So I guess in a way what I'm saying, and this is kind of more of a thinking aloud discussion, is we've got to step way outside the boxes, public, private, government, non-government, and ask ourselves comprehensively, to your point, where do we get the yuck factor? This is not a judicial principle. This is kind of a legislative argument. Where do we feel that, what are we worried about? Are we worried about being put in jail? Are we worried about our financial and personal secrets being broadcast around the world, you know, et cetera? And then how do we protect the interests that we think a society ought to be protected? And how do we build protections that at each level are calibrated against the value of having the information for certain kinds of purposes? And then I think you wind up with at least a thoughtful taxonomy that says, here's what you can do to protect life. Here's what you can do for other purposes. Here's what you can do for commercial purposes. And we then have a societal understanding and agreement on what the framework ought to be. So that's the best answer I can come up to in terms of your yuck response. But yeah.
Hi, Sharon Bradford Franklin with the Constitution Project. You drew a distinction between, on the one hand, you said something that emanates a signal, like maybe OnStar or a GPS phone, where you said maybe a probable cause standard would be appropriate, versus video surveillance or drone with cameras. And I'm wondering if what you were getting at was maybe the sense that the emanation of a signal is beyond what an officer could do. And if you looked then at a video surveillance system where you had a network of cameras and you could, through facial recognition, maybe go and actually track a given individual through your database of footage, whether that would come closer to the former example, and you would think that you're getting closer to where a warrant is required to actually track a person through that database rather than they're standing there in front of one camera.
Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, I think on the emanations point, I probably am reflecting an intuition that the signal would not be perceptible to a human being unaided. So it's kind of a more like Kylo. The example you made with the video camera is a little bit different because facial recognition actually can be done by a human being. We all do it. So the camera isn't giving you a capability that a human doesn't have. What it's doing is it's allowing you to do it at higher volume. But in theory, if you're willing to have the officers standing on every corner looking for a suspect, you're doing exactly the same thing. I mean, I'll give you a great example. I mean, you have had circumstances, you've probably seen movies where, you know, there's a potential assassination in a particular location, and they bring a lot of police in, they're all looking, they have a picture of the person they're looking for, they're looking for that person. So human beings can do that. It's very resource intensive. So there, I'm not sure the facial recognition is anything more than an efficiency tool that allows you to do that function much more cheaply and much more comprehensively. Now, maybe that still ought to bother us, but it's a different kind of issue. Yes.
Hi, Mr. Secretary. Ellen Nakashima with the Washington Post. Good to see you again. I really appreciate the discussion about the analytics because I don't think there's enough attention paid or understanding of what the capabilities are and what the government can do or might be able to do with that. And to your point about all of the masses of data being collected, seemingly innocuous little pieces of data that might be in the open source, but when put together like a mosaic, you might come up with a more clear and startling picture. Some people call it the mosaic theory. Do you think that one of the key issues is the way in which law enforcement or intelligence might be able to analyze the data if it's based on, say, a pattern as opposed to having some sort of predicate, subject-based predicate, that might give you more reason to look into all of these masses of data? Some people might be more concerned about the so-called pattern-based searches where you don't have any necessary predicate, and so you might have a higher degree of false positives and higher risk of drawing innocent people into an investigation. I'd just like to hear your comments on that.
Well, I think, you know, for those who are, maybe want a little bit of illumination of the distinction, you know, basically, and this goes back, I think, quite a ways, there are two ways you can use analytics. One is what some people call link analysis. You're essentially looking to see if individuals are connected or connected to some third party, or there's some financial, communicative, travel, or other relationship that links somebody to somebody that's known to be a bad person. The other is to look at behavioral characteristics, either of kind of what a norm of someone doing certain things would do, or that's a white list or a black list of certain behavioral characteristics that would be associated with a person who is thinking of doing something bad. I mean, certain kinds of surveillance patterns, for example, would be linked to someone who might be considering doing a terrorist act. Both of these are used, and frankly, are used without technology. I mean, I'm going to go back to my own experience when I was doing organized crime cases in New York back in the 80s. We didn't have any of these computer analytics. You did it the old-fashioned way. You sat down with pieces of paper and moved them around, and you relied on your brain to remember, oh, didn't I see this before? And then you'd riffle through some stuff, and you go, aha, this guy was here, here, and here at a certain time, and that was your link analysis. Likewise, with pattern behavior, you'd look at someone's behavior. There was a guy who, this is a simple example, every time there was a conversation between certain people, they would leave the restaurant and they'd go and walk around, which is what we call counter surveillance. So that was a pattern of behavior that suggested to you these people are doing something they don't want to be overheard talking about. So there's nothing new about these things. Now, obviously, they're much more intense. Here's my answer. I think the link analysis is easier but less valuable. What the pattern analysis gives you, again, I'll go back to my own experience. You know, after 9/11, when I was the head of the criminal division, you know, a week after 9/11, you're saying to yourself, you had 19 people in this country. We didn't pick it up at all. How do we know where the next 19 are? Are we going to rely upon whether one or two of them happen to have been picked up on an audio or video surveillance and we can do a link analysis? Or is there something about the way they conducted their business that would allow us to say, you know, people doing certain things ought to at least be on our radar screen? This, by the way, is something we do at the borders. When you come in, if you're a non-U.S. citizen and you talk to your border inspector, he's asking you questions. He's looking for certain things that might cue him off that you need to be the subject of a closer look. So to abandon that capability, to look at patterns and find where somebody might be doing something that warrants a closer look, would really rob us of a huge tool. However, let me come back to the Fourth Amendment. Part of the genius of the Fourth Amendment, or the way the doctrine's developed, is it recognizes there are certain things that we can do that will justify a certain action, but no more. So to do the, you know, lightest type of interaction, interview somebody, ask them a few questions, it's quite a low threshold. I mean, you can do it on the street based on an articulable suspicion. You wouldn't, however, put someone in jail based on that. For that, you need proof beyond a reasonable doubt. I would argue that if you use pattern analysis properly, it does nothing more than say, you need to take a closer look at this. It doesn't say the person is disqualified from a job or is automatically not admissible in the country or gets punished. It simply means let's look a little bit deeper. And then if you look a little deeper and you get a little bit more, you get to the next level. That's why I think in the end, it's hard to answer questions about analytics and even collection unless you ask what is the action that's going to be predicated on that. And I think if you look at that, you wind up with a much more carefully textured menu of options than if you treat it as a binary proposition. Yes.
Yes, I'm Sam Wright, an attorney and retired Navy JAG Corps. I remember a couple of years ago I heard you speak, I think it was a Federalist Society function, and you suggested that, I hope I'm not mischaracterizing what you said, you suggested you were troubled by the suggestion that while it would be necessary to get a judicial warrant to wiretap al-Awlaki's telephone, that the administration was suggesting that no judicial authorization whatsoever was necessary to kill it. I wonder if you've thought more about that or if...
I don't know if I said I was troubled. I might have said it was anomalous. It goes back to my earlier point, which is one of the reasons I actually think it's a fascinating time to be a lawyer and to think about legal problems now. Every once in a while, you run up into a collision of legal rules. Each of the rules at the time it was formed made perfect sense. But the outcomes, you know, scratch your head. It's like that old saying attributed, I forget to who, the law is an ass. I don't personally have a problem with what happened with Awlaki, however that happened, you know, and I don't know, I'm just going by the newspapers. But I see the anomaly between saying, you know, you can't intercept someone's conversations, but you can kill them. So now that means we have to change the rule on intercepting conversations. But to me, these anomalies challenge us to think about whether we are being too ritualistic in applying rules, as opposed to stepping back and saying, what are the interests we're protecting, and what is the hierarchy of value we ought to put on those interests? Yeah, Ben.
So I want to come back to the yuck factor and ask the sort of mirror image question. Your former policy deputy, Stuart Baker, returned in his book to the Brandeis article on the Brandeis Warren article on the right to privacy, and concluded somewhat colorfully that he thought Brandeis, this is a quote, was a wuss. And whenever we have these conversations, I come back and think, you know, maybe that's just us a few years from now, and the real problem is not legal, it's just cultural. that we're not sort of used to the idea yet that we're all getting used to and we're all going to be used to, which is that everybody, every corporation, and every government walks around about us and about each other with the infinite ability to process all information to which it's lawfully entitled. And the real answer is just get used to that. And I'm interested for your thoughts on that.
Yeah. Well, I may be wrong in the attribution. I think Larry Ellison or someone like that said, your privacy is gone, get over it. And this really comes back to this idea of the reasonable expectation of privacy. And really, as I'm up here thinking about Jones, I'm wondering whether really what the court was saying is, look, don't make us do this. This is an area which preeminently cries out for Congress or state legislatures to really decide what the public's expectation of privacy is, because it's going to be very hard with a straight face to argue that the government can't do things that Amazon does. I don't know how you're going to make that argument. I guess the court often finds itself in a position where they're the default because nothing else is done. But it may very well be at the end that we do wind up saying something like this. What's important is what you do with the information, not what you collect or analyze. And that the focal point ought to be on what you can do with the information you can collect, who you can give it to, what action you can take based on it. And this goes back to my mission creep point. This is the hardest self-discipline to impose on government, which is you collect something for a particular purpose that everybody says, yeah, this is worth doing. And then pretty soon someone comes up and says, well, I know you collected it for terrorism, but there's a bank fraud case here, really bad bank fraud, Bernie Madoff. Can't we use that information? And then there's a big tax fraud case. And then, someone didn't pay their child support. And you wind up moving all the way to the point that parking tickets become subject to this. It came up with Easy Pass. Someone raised the question that, what a great way to get speeding tickets. If you're going from point A to point B and, you go through the toll booth, and I can do the math and see that you couldn't have gotten there if you traveled less than 70 miles an hour, I send you a ticket. And wiser heads said, no, we're not doing that, because if we do that, there won't be Easy Pass, because no one will do it. So to me, the discipline of saying sometimes we're going to collect and we won't let the government use it for certain purposes is part of the solution to that problem. And I think that's a lot of where the discomfort is. But, people, if you look at folks who are 20 or 30 years younger than I am now, they seem to have expectations about privacy that are very different. They're willing to talk about things and reveal things that I would never reveal. And so what does that mean? And maybe you're right. Maybe this will change, and maybe that's part of the message of Jones.
Bill Freed, I'm an 8th grade U.S. history teacher. And based on what you just said, what I have to ask or say may be a mute point. But when we cover the Constitution, one of the points I try to make, from my opinion, is that the Constitution and the Bill of Rights are there to limit the power of government and to keep them off our backs as citizens. And what you were just saying kind of speaks to that. It's not so much the information they're gathering. How can I trust my government not to misuse it? They made seatbelts be installed in every car. Then they required that children be buckled up. Then they required that adults be buckled up, but they couldn't pull you over for that. Now any policeman can pull you over if he suspects that you're not buckled up. So how do we keep the government out of our lives?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's it. Look, I mean, you can't buy the light bulbs you want anymore. And it's like unbelievable the amount of micromanagement. If you're buying a new house, the toilets have to be done in a certain way. Really, it's unbelievable. Again, though, what's important is to focus on maybe the precise issue. I think the issue you're raising, which goes back to my point to Ben earlier, is maybe a lot of our concern is about what the government does rather than what it has. Maybe I'm speaking for myself. I'm not troubled by the idea of a very robust information collection analytics to prevent people from coming in and blowing up this building. I am troubled by that for purposes of making sure that, you know, you're recycling properly and not, you know, throwing plastic into the garbage. So maybe a lot of it is setting rules about what the boundaries ought to be on what you can do with things. And then to another point, and again, I mean, it pains me to say I'm learning something from the Europeans, because I was notorious when I was secretary for being pretty hard pushing back against the European vision of privacy. And I think their answers I don't agree with, but they do ask questions sometimes that are interesting. So they ask them the question about, again, proportionality. Is it worth collecting for this purpose? The other question they ask about right to forget, again, it's, you know, I don't think the answer is you have a right to have everything forgotten, but it might suggest that over a period of time you do erase or seriously circumscribe how you get into, how you, you know, what information you can recall. You know, the deal we did with them when we did our passenger's name record treaty created tiers of time. There was an initial period you could look at information relatively freely, and then after a certain period of time, it was held, but it was no longer capable of being recalled unless you had a particular reason to get it back. Again, without suggesting that's the optimal solution, there are a lot of little levers you can use in terms of how you use information, how long you keep it, who gets access to it, that go a long way to ameliorate some of the concerns I think that I've heard in the room and that I frankly share, without putting you in the position we would never want to be in, and I speak from personal experience here, that you have a 9/11 and you'd never want to be able to you'd never want to say, I had the information to stop that, and I wasn't able to connect the dots. I mean, that's the trauma many of us who were involved on that day, you know, still very, very carefully remember. So how do you balance that? And I'm just trying to suggest some different tools that can be used to set this taxonomy up.
Secretary, thank you very much.